Ladies and gentlemen, Colonel Bud Anderson. I have to say, Bud, you couldn't see that video, but in one of those last pictures, it had a picture of two little kids in your arms. Those two little kids are here with you. I hope they'll come out at the end of this presentation. Bud is very fortunate to have two wonderful children. Jim and Kitty are here escorting him, and they take good care of you, Bud, don't they?
They're my senior children.
Your senior kids now? Well, Bud, let's start out at 100 years old. What's a typical day like for a 100-year-old fella at Oshkosh? How's your day been going today? What'd you do?
Well, today, let's see. It got me up real early. About 9 o'clock.
Well, but that's real early California time.
Yeah. And we got dressed and went out to the airfield. Came out to the airfield right away and watched my airplanes fly, P-51s and this new P-39. I'm 100 years old, so I'll get two or three of these while I'm here. Anyway, I came out to the airfield here, and we watched the airplanes land and take off and land and come in, and it was really wonderful to see these Mustangs, and these are two guys that own these Mustangs. Then I believe it or not, I had a flight in a TF P-51, one with the dual control, and I had a little bit of help out there getting in and out of it. Those of you who haven't seen it, they got two or three huge work benches, got them up. And I think they were thinking about getting a crane and lowering me into the thing. And then Rob Gordon took me out in this twin. It was an actual two-seater with its dual controls. And we went up and took a lot of pictures and just had a great time. I haven't... I haven't been in a P-51 since I was about 85, where I actually flew it.
Yeah, so if I could interject here, when he says in a P-51, you were still flying a P-51, thanks to Jack Roush, when you were 80? In your late 70s or 80, I think you were still actually flying the airplane.
70s and 80s, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So he's had a great life in that 100 years. So let's move to Jack Roush. You've known Bud for how long?
Since 1994, I got to a point in my life where I could afford to spend some money on something other than my family and my business. And my heart went right to a P-51, and I started looking for a project that I could buy. And I finally found an airplane that was being housed in City Airport in Michigan. And it had a motif on it that wasn't reflective of anybody's brave career in the air. But we fixed that. I asked around. I met a fellow by the name of Mickey Rupp that was racing in a P-51 at Reno. And he knew Ed and Connie Boland and introduced me to them early on. The community of Warbird owners and operators was very protective of the airplanes and the people that flew them. And I think in my case, they were afraid that that I'd do something silly with the airplane and embarrass the community. So they kept me between the fences, kept me on the straight and narrow. I looked for an identity to attach to the airplane, and they sent me to see Bud. They said that he had the history documents, documented history of everybody, of every ace that had flown the Mustangs. And I told him what I was up to, and he sent me, he didn't send me the originals, he sent me photocopies of pictures of airplanes. He wasn't sure if he'd make that investment in me, I guess. But anyway, from the photocopies, I got the idea that maybe I'd missed something. And I went back and asked if an airplane had been painted up like Bud's, and it turned out that there had been one in Europe. But Mickey Rupp had one here, but he'd taken the paint job someplace else for his racer. And I talked to Mickey, and he agreed that he'd like for me to reassociate Bud's career with his military service with an airplane that I was building. And I got a call immediately once I let it be known that's what I was going to do. I heard from Ed Boland and from Chuck Yeager, called me right away. He says he was glad to have me, glad that I made the decision to paint an airplane like Andy's. He said, with the 50th anniversary of the sound barrier that I broke, and with the 50th anniversary of the of the Air Force, that 50th or 25th, maybe it was 25th anniversaries, that there'd be lots of opportunities to fly the airplanes and to attract attention to the patriotic young Americans that what had been done to preserve our freedoms. And so I painted an airplane, painted the Old Crow D model, duplicate of what had been known about the airplane in the service, and took it to Myrtle Beach for the first reunion in I think 93, maybe 94. It was when it was in Myrtle Beach, and I've been fast friends with Bud. He's been patient with me, and he's taught me a lot. I've enjoyed his friendship and certainly celebrate his patriotism.
Well, and thank you, Jack, for all that you've done. So let's fast forward just a little bit. But at this, yes, thank you, Jack. And in the Warbird community, we're all very appreciative that Jack became involved and interested in the P-51, because a lot of the engines now and a lot of the maintenance and where we are with the safety issues with the airplanes, we can thank Jack for his work and his engineering expertise and his passion for making them safer for all of us to fly. It's thank you, Jack, for that also.
My pleasure. When Jim Hagedorn came to visit with me, he was interested in the airplanes, and he told me that he'd like for me to help him find an airplane. And I heard that he'd been flying a Mooney over New York on his way to Manhattan, on his way to Long Island, rather, where he lived. And he'd had a couple of engine out emergencies and landed in places that you'd rather not take an airplane. And I told him that there were three airplanes that would do that mission for him, that I had two of them under construction, and I had one that was complete. And so he agreed to take the responsibility, the stewardship for the Old Crow D model. And I resented a little bit that I'd taken the identity that put it on a B model. He called it the Focro, rather than. But anyway, he's been a great friend, and he's been protected the airplane as well as I had, and we're in good shape with Jim.
Well, that's what I was going to say. We could fast forward just a little bit. Jack was having another D model made, and as it turned out, it's in the paint scheme Gentleman Jim that was also one of Bud's best friends' paint scheme. And as he was finishing the new D and working on the faux crow, the B model old crow, then when the D model old crow, I guess it needed a new home. I think Jack interviewed Jim, I guess you can say that. And Jim, would you relate your version of what did Jack make you go through to do that? Yeah, you're hot.
Jack is a total liar. So we were looking to sponsor a NASCAR vehicle.
Truck.
Was it a truck we started
it
with?
Was
or
a truck.
I think we were like cup white back
you
in those
You can
early
choose
days.
Which one of them you believe.
Anyhow, so we're going up there. People say, you know, Roush's got a couple of Mustangs. Would you like to go flying with him? Sure. So I never met the dude before. And he says, you want to go flying? I said, sure. And we jump in the back of, I think it was the, at the time, the Gentleman Jim plane was a glamorous Glennis plane. And so we hop in the back, and I've never met this guy before. Okay, I don't know. You know, it's weird when people give rides and get rides, but I've never met this dude before. We take off, and next thing you know, we're like at red line, below the tree line, and Jack is just scaring the crap out of me.
I had a choice. He was a potential sponsor for my race team, and I could treat him like I was worried about hurting him, or I could go out and set my hair on fire and catch his on fire, too.
So, well, listen, my hair caught fire, and so Jack, I was interested in getting an airplane, and he said, I'll sell you the glamorous Glennis airplane. So I got my heart all set on it. Then he called up and said, I can't sell you the glamorous Glennis airplane. I can sell you the Gentleman Jim airplane, which was the luckiest day of my life because I think that that airplane, that D model over there, is a fabulous, reliable, sweet flying, like you have no idea. But anyway, so Jack agrees to sell it to me, but I don't have like military heavy tailwheel time.
This guy was a Czech pilot for F-16s.
I had F-16 hours, active Air Force, and that was great, 7 years. But so Jack says, well, I'll come to your office, and when he shows up, he's going to interview me. This is not a joke. It's, am I good enough? And I get the idea. Am I good enough to basically steward this piece of military history? I mean, now think about it. It's totally right. But here's the weird thing. He makes me sign a contract that I will never change the name of the airplane from Bud's name. Yeah, except here's the thing. What he didn't tell me is I'm building another one. He told me how special it was. And then he built, and that's why I call it the faux crow, you know, like not the real crow. But am I supposed to talk now, or are we going to go around and around?
At some point, you know, we'll give John a chance to talk here. But it's
well, he's
the
new guy.
Yeah, like, I know he's so okay.
Go, new guy.
Yeah, okay. So new guy. Okay, tell us how. Okay, this was a true paint scheme that is exactly like Bud's airplane that he had early on, the P-39 they had in training. But anyway, John, tell us a little bit about this airplane.
Yeah, I came across, first of all, what an honor and privilege to be up here, Connie, and to be with these gentlemen. I've been coming to Oshkosh with my brother for, I don't know, over 20 years, but of course, getting to have the opportunity to see Warbirds in review, and thank you. And to see Bud Anderson, to be up here today in front of this with Colonel Anderson, 100 years old, what an honor and privilege, something I'll never forget. We've had this P-39. This is actually a Q model. It was built in May of 1943. And we've had this airplane in the Central Texas Commemorative Air Force since 1962 is when it came to us. So it's one of our original airplanes in the CAF. And then John Stokes, who was our founder in 1974 of the Central Texas Wing, ended up having it restored. And we've been the caretakers of this P-39 since then. And over the years, it's had many different paint schemes, and including one of the early paint schemes was a Russian Lend-Lease paint scheme. And then one of our members, about 2.5 years ago, I believe it was, Vern came up and let us know that, hey, there was an Old Crow P-39. And I don't know about the rest of y'all. I had no idea. I always thought about the B model and D model P-51s being Old Crows, but had no idea that Colonel Anderson cut his teeth in fighters with a P-39 and actually personalized the original Old Crow was a P-39.
That's okay, Bud. That leads us into, okay, you had the P-39. I believe you weren't in Oroville. You were in Casper. Where did you fly the P-39 first, and then how did it come to be an Old Crow?
Well, when I got out of flying school, I wanted to be a fighter pilot. Not sure where that came from, but I guess it was watching the Battle of Britain newsreels, something like that. And so we needed pilots everywhere, so if you could convince your instructor that you'd be a good fighter pilot, your chances were very good of being able to do that. So my first duty assignment was in the San Francisco Bay Area. I went to Hamilton Field with duty at the Oakland Municipal Airport. And it was a replacement pilot training group, and you went there and flew for about 3 months, and then you went off to some fighter group in the world and fought the war. Well, when my time came up, at Oakland is where I checked out in the P-39s, old D models, and we moved around all over the place, but I didn't. When my 3 months came up, they said, "No, you're not going to. You're not going to go fight yet. You're going to go to Tonopah, Nevada, and join the brand new 357th Fighter Group that's being activated for World War II. We'll be the first people in it." And the lucky part of it was I get a whole new training cycle. And also, I'll be at least a flight leader, which is a good deal if you're going to go fight a war with all the guys you've trained. So while we're moving around the United States, we move up, and we first got a Q model just before we went overseas, and the Q model that I remember had a power lever, and it pushed the mixture, RPM, and manifold pressure up with one lever. And I thought that was kind of interesting. This is a Q model,
yes, sir.
Right, John?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Well, tell me, but okay, it ended up with the Old Crow paint scheme. Well, what happened to the Old Crow airplane? What happened to that P-39?
Well, we had it at, we finally moved to Casper, Wyoming. just before we went overseas, and I had a brand new P-39Q was all mine, and I'm not sure where the first place we painted the old Corolla on it, but a lot of people want to know, why'd you name it the old Corolla? Well, I wanted to have something to do with flying, and I wanted to have something to do with drinking. Because that's what we did. But I tell my Baptist friends, it's named after the most intelligent bird in the sky, the crow. And the crow is a very canny bird. And so that part of it's true, but my drinking buddies all know it's named after that Kentucky Straight Bourbon whiskey.
And Ellie was okay with this, because a lot of airplanes are named after the wife, huh?
Yeah, she says, most guys name their airplane after their sweetheart or their wife. What do they think's going on here? Anyway, when we got to Casper, we were just getting ready to go overseas. And a guy by the name of Chuck Yeager flew my airplane and had some landing gear malfunction. And he had to suck the gear back up and belly landed in and pretty well ruined the airplane. A couple of days later, he bailed out of another one and got two of them in a week's time. Not his fault, actually.
A few years later, I lost a T6 too. That's okay. Okay, moving right along. Okay, thanks, Jim. Okay, so Bud, after you left Tonopah, you went to England with the 357th Fighter Group, and what's one of the stories that you think the people in the audience here would like to hear about your adventures, if we'll call it that, in flying in Europe? A guy on your tail or something like that, which was very unusual.
You want a war story?
Yeah, we need a war story.
You guys want a war story?
Yeah. And that doesn't mean it has to be true, but just the way you remember it. Just the way you remember it, we'll be fine.
Well, I got several I could tell. I'm going to tell a different one. Just changed my mind.
You could do anything you want to do.
And by the way, fighter pilots have to use their hands. You cannot tell a story without using your hands. If I had to sit on my hands here, I wouldn't be able to tell you this story. So, this will also tell people what a quarter of a kill is, how I got a quarter of a kill. But this was a long-range flight. We were going to go all the way back to Poland. That's the thing about the P-51. It had such good range and good endurance. And that's what you needed in Europe to protect the bombers and go after the Luftwaffe. Actually, when you fill the thing full of fuel to go to your maximum range, it made the airplane a little unstable. By unstable, I mean you're in a turn like this, and you're pulling, you're putting G's on top of you. You're getting pushed down in your seat, and you're holding quite a bit of force to do this. And suddenly, or gradually, it the force changes and you're not pulling on it, and you end up pushing forward on the stick, which is very unusual for flying. To keep the thing in a tight turn, you're pushing forward on the stick to do that. Some people had a little trouble coping with that, but I hadn't been to test pilot school and I didn't know it was dangerous, so I just flew it like you had to fly it. And after that, you burned out just half the 85 gallons in your back tank. The thing flew like a dream. Anyway, we're way deep into Germany, and we hear on the radio that they're being attacked up at the front of our column that we're protecting. So we shove the throttle up and head on up. I'm the number one guy in a four-ship flight. So we get up there, and you can see them. There was the ME-109. Here's the bomber stream coming like this. And here come four ME-109s flying line up abreast. They come straight through the bombers, shoot down two of them, roll over, go down, and start to go out front like they're going to come make another pass. Well, we caught up with them about that time, cut them off the pass, and I singled out and had this one guy. And we're dogfighting. Here's the bombers are coming along just like this. And we're out here circling like this. The bombers are moving forward. We're not. We're just moving. We're staying in the same general position. And pretty soon I can see the B-17 windshields and, the distinct parts of the airplane. And I said, oh boy, I hope this guy doesn't want to go through those bombers. And I hope he breaks off first and dives away. But that's going to put him at a disadvantage because I'll then get on his tail. So sure enough, he breaks out, goes down, dives, and then I just follow him. He got quite a head start, though, and we're going down to about 5,000 feet. And so he stretches it out, turns around, and I'm coming down like this. He's turning. I think, oh my God, if I don't get a shot off here, he's going to be able to get a shot off at me head on, and head on passes are no fun. And so I said, okay, Jesus, and quickly I get a good sight picture on him. I'd been through three gunnery schools and I shot quail as a kid. And I got off a burst and then just went whew, by him. And I noticed that my wingman afterwards is following me. And when he went by him, he says, Bud, you hit that guy on the front of the airplane. The cowling came off, the propeller came off, and you hit him all over the front of the airplane, including the cockpit. And he turns like this, pulls up and rolls over and bails out. Okay, I got this guy. So while we were dogfighting, that we had two more guys there, the rest of my flight took care of. I noticed this one thing about being a fighter pilot. It's called situational awareness. You got to know what's going on, not just you and the one enemy. And so you got to know what's going around in the whole area. Well, while I was in this dogfight, I noticed a shadow on the ground, and I could see the direction he was going. This was midday, clear as a bell, and over green forest. And it had a big meadow in it, a huge big meadow in the middle of it. So we polished these guys off and said, "Hey, anybody see a shadow down here?" "No, no, no." "Okay, get in here, get in line abreast, and we're going to go this way, west." And the last direction I noticed the shadow was going. So we're flying along about 5,000 feet. And I see the shadow again up ahead of me, way up ahead. And I still can't see the airplane. If it had been a hazy day, I would have not seen him at all. But when I see him there, okay, we get over here and we head up toward him. We pull up alongside, and I look down here, and here's an old Battle of Britain Heinkel 111 bomber. And it's obsolete now, and it's probably being used as a transport. So I pull up there and I say, "Oh boy, how about this?" Like shooting a fish in a barrel. And then I thought a little bit. I said, "You know, my guys in my flight don't get to shoot very often when they're flying with me." And so I said, "God darn, this is a good chance to get everybody in action." And so I said, "Okay, whatever our flight number was, get into practice gunnery formation." And you never saw three guys get into left echelon so fast they damn near ran into each other. Because they knew that meant, "Oh, we're going to get to shoot." And when you're doing this practice, here's your target being towed here. And you go into echelon left, you roll in and make a left-hand pursuit curve at the target, slide out here, go up on the other side. And then number two does the same thing. When you've made four passes, then you come back and do it in the right-hand side. So I go in first, and we got an engine smoking. Pretty soon we had one burning and one smoking. And it had a gunner in the back, and we silenced him. And I was making my second pass, and I'd watched the number four guy, and he was a new head. And I know he knew better, but he emptied he shot all of his ammunition in one pass. And that's pretty hard to do, because you don't want to do it that way, because you burn your barrels out, and pretty soon they're coming out like this. And but I knew he was just being eager, over eager. And so I scored him with a one hit on his last pass. We only had about 30 seconds worth of firepower. And so he wanted to use it in five seconds or somewhere in that neighborhood. And that might be a little long. And so you have ammo and you don't want to come home empty. That's a long way home, 2.5 hours. So I said I would have missed him if it had been a hazy day. I wonder if I haven't got my stories mixed up.
No, I think the point is the poor guy was a sitting duck, and you all got to practice.
Yeah,
I'd like to say that shows leadership on your part, that you're thinking of your men, and that's a nice point we can all take away. You've been a good leader your whole life. But, you know, they said they wanted to hear all of your war stories, so you maybe did you just combine them all? But I don't think so.
Anyway, I got it now.
You got it now.
The guy was getting lower and lower and lower, and he was aiming for this big meadow. And he was right on the deck. He couldn't climb up. They couldn't bail out. And so finally he crash lands into the, he's got fire on one engine and the other one is just about to catch on fire. And so he bellies it in and he hits something really hard on the leading edge of a left wing. And that broke the outer wing panel off. And they skidded to get down together and hit another rock and kind of ended up about like this. And this one guy, two guys got out of it. And the one guy gets out and he goes, he's looking up there and we're going, around there like angry bees. And the other guy starts running across this meadow. There is no place to hide, believe me. And I said, you dumbass. I'm going to give you a thrill. So I came down, he's running like this, and I go right over the top of him, pulled up and did a roll. And then we got our flight together and went home. And that's how you get a quarter of a kill.
You know, if you happen to, you know, there are some connections that are made after the war where, you know, you have a German who relates a story with an American. Would you like to hear that guy's side of the story? It's like, yeah, this P-51 came over me. And speaking of the German side, it's going to be a real treat tomorrow. We have two ME-109s and that will be here in Warbirds in Review tomorrow. Bud became really good friends with Gunther Rall, who flew the 109 in Germany. So we have Dr. Kurt Bratz will be with us tomorrow to talk about Gunther's role in the war and what it was like to fight in the 109. Bud, you have something?
Yeah. He had 275 victories. And he says, you know, everywhere I go, people say, how come the Germans got so many victories? And he says, it's pretty simple. He said, when the Spanish had their civil war down there in Spain, he says, we went down there and started flying combat. This is in the late 30s and late 30s. And then when we came back, we overran these small countries, the Netherlands. We could destroy their whole air force in a day or two. And like Poland and Finland. And he said, whenever we took off, we were in a target-rich environment. And he spent a lot of his time on the Russian front. And in their early days, he said, before they got some good airplanes, flying in Russia was like target shooting. And so he says, then we end up fighting over our own country and more targets than we can possibly cover, you know, with a raid of 1,000 B-17s and 800-900 fighters. Then so he finishes it. He can speak real good English, but he used his German, exaggerated German accent. And he said, the German pilots had a choice. You either got a Iron Cross or a Wooden Cross. And that was pretty much too. They flew until they were killed.
Yeah, they put in a lot of flight time, and they flew over their own country, as Bud said. But we'll cover this tomorrow, I'm sure. But Gunther was shot down 8 times, but he'd walk home or whatever and get in another airplane and go again.
Yeah.
But a wonderful gentleman fighting for his country, like all of our people were.
Warrior.
That's what we were. Jack, speaking of warriors, do you have a war story about flying with Bud, or would you like to talk to us about your airplanes a little bit and the differences in the B and the D and the armament or the horsepower? Go for it.
The D and the B were within 50 horsepower or so, as long as they had the Rolls-Royce Merlin engine. There was a little bit of difference in the tune-up, but they both performed pretty much the same. The B model behind me it was more of a hand-built airplane than the Ds were. They built less than 4,000 Bs and Cs. The Bs and Cs are the same airplane. The Cs were built in Dallas, Texas, and the Bs were built in Englewood, California, but they were built in the same specs. But they spent time on those, making sure that all the rivet heads were flush. And they really rubbed on the B model because they were anxious to really showcase the Merlin engine and to demonstrate to the Luftwaffe that they couldn't compete with what we were putting out there. The B model is about 15 knots faster than the D model, and that doesn't mean it too much in a dogfight. It gets you someplace faster, but I'm sure Bud would have not noticed the difference in top speed. But the B model was just fitted with 450 caliber guns, and there was a problem with the loading of the ammunition. If the G's were high, if you're pulling hard on the airplane in a turn and you fired the gun, you could jam your bullets, and then you couldn't use your gun anymore. So that was the problem. But with the B, when they went to 6 guns on the D model, they fixed that. But Bud, looking at his B models, he flew his entire first tour with 3 B model airframes. A lot of pilots and not many airplanes that were capable of the missions at that time. And your airplane went every day, regardless of whether you were ready to fly. So his old Crow B model was flown by a number of other pilots. And it was two of them were shot down with Bud not in it. He finished his first tour with the airframe that I've replicated here from an image point of view. And he was anxious to finish with that airplane, he said, because the guns were reliable and the airframe was reliable. And he was, I don't think he knew to start with he was going to run a fly a second tour. But he went over to the States, and they had the psychiatrist working on him and trying to tell him he was crazy to go back in the war, but they didn't talk him out of it. He went back in the war, and he got a D model that was twice as numerous as the B's, and he was able to fly it just himself and finish his whole tour with the D.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you. I'd like to go to Jim now. Do you have a favorite Bud Anderson story to relate, or an airplane? Have you ever scared yourself in the Old Crow? I retract that.
I was cheating in some dogfighting we were doing, and I didn't know I'd burned the motor, but no, we'd like the. Jack would be able to tape, I think it's the number one in six pistons, or cylinders.
There's a propensity in a couple of the pistons
it
to burn.
It tends to run a little bit leaner all the way in the front of the motor. And, you know, when you're dogfighting somebody else and people say you should keep the power setting at a certain level, you know, fighter pilots always want more power, don't they, Bud?
Right.
So I probably had my power up a little bit, and... then the whole summer, the engine's running rough. We couldn't figure it out. Jack was changing out magnetos. And
he hadn't been honest with me at that point. He hadn't told me what he did.
You mean I was cheating? Anyhow, Jack took the engine apart after the air show. And Connie's husband, we've been trying to figure out why is it running a little rough. So it tells you something about the reliability of these sort of Packard Merlins is, you know, I burned the edge of a piston off. I mean, it was, there was one ring left, one oil control ring left, but everything else had been burned out, and Jack and Draper pulled off the oil filter.
I got off the sodium pentothal, I got the dripping water, the light going back and forth.
No, and I didn't rat myself out. But it was when they cut the oil filter open and it looked like silver or sort of talcum powder. That was when, I have that piston on my desk now.
He made a rookie mistake in not keeping his RPM ahead of his manifold pressure. And guess who also did that one time earlier?
Look, I know everybody's hot out here. I'm going to talk about something a little different, which is kind of what we do here every day and, like, what our day-to-day was. So, we brief at, like, 5:30 in the morning. Ray Fowler over there is our leader. And what's important here is I used to be the young guy here. And, like, I'm going to be 67 in a couple weeks. And so what you can see is... there's a new, younger group of, you know, men and some women flying warbirds here. And so, you know, if you ever want to, like, see what happens here for the fighter guys, we brief at 5:30 in the morning right over here. And I think we got three flights in, including flying with Bud, which was, I mean, no, you think about it. It's a boondoggle because when I say boondoggle, it's a boondoggle because we had two photo missions to do with Bud. So we had a B-25 photo ship. We had a Baron or something, some Beechcraft thing, but slow. And I think we had like seven fighters up against it. And we had to get pictures with Bud. And it's a lot of work to sort of put the whole thing together. We had a few minutes to go play and chase each other around on the other side of the lake. But by 10 a.m., we were done. Had a kind of near emergency because the plane which would have been screwed up. I don't know if people saw the plane. It just stopped running right on the ramp here because it had a – it started streaming fuel pretty much up where we were doing the photo mission on the way home. And we didn't declare an emergency, but we immediately headed back. And then the airplane just stopped running on the ramp. So, you know, this is one of those things where, you know, Jack talked about the group of people, including Bud and Connie's late husband, Ed, and Connie, and a bunch of people who welcomed the new owners of these warbirds. And you can't say too much about Lee Lauterbach's operation down at Stallion in Kissimmee, where I think a lot of people go to get their initial checkout in the P-51. But the best flying that happens, I think, probably in the world, happens this week in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And it's as close to, you know, we're flying four ships or more every single flight. We're doing at least three flights a day. I think these guys went up and flew a kind of make-a-wish flight yesterday down south of here. Got back barely at 8. They had to convince the controller, because the airport closed at 8, that no, like, your watch is wrong. We're good. But this place is designed for kind of seeing all kinds of stuff. And for the pilots that are here, there's just nothing better. And this group of people, you know, and you're the new guy, but there's a whole new generation of people. We need to sort of start getting them up, I think, to talk. But it's a real privilege to fly and to do it with Jack and Bud and Connie and her late husband and her new husband, Ed, another Ed, and flying with the P-39. Just really great fun. And Oshkosh is ridiculous. It's so awesome. So, you know, it's a privilege to be here with y'all.
Thank you, Jim. And I'm going to stand up here. I know it's hard to keep your foot tied down for any time at all. So if you want to exit, that's fine. But I'm going to talk to the new guy.
Just give me the heave-ho.
No, I'm not giving you the heave-ho. We have, let me see, booted off the island. I think we did that to you in one missing man formation that I took part in. So his radio quit and said, okay, I'm now the one that's going to pull Jim's out. But he couldn't talk to us. But anyway, to John, the new guy, and Bud, the P-39 is more unusual than the Mustang. So, John, I wonder if we could walk over to your P-39 just for a moment here. And, Bud, just hang with us here. Are you okay? It's a little hot, but okay. So, first of all, John, tell us about this thing that's sticking out.
I mean, that's a 37-millimeter cannon. So this is kind of the predecessor for the A-10. Back in the day. So up here in the front, where you'd have normally the engine, is where they housed the 37-millimeter cannon. Had about 30 rounds, Bud, about 30. And then two 50-cal machine guns, Browning machine guns, that would shoot through. And so Bell Aircraft, this is very unique in many ways, but Bell Aircraft figured out that in order to have the cannon, which was extremely heavy, especially the rounds and the ammunition up front, they were able to have the cannon fire straight through the prop here. And by doing that, they put the engine, as you can see, the Allison engine in the back. There is a drive shaft, I think it's like close to 11-foot long drive shaft, that comes underneath the pilot legs, and then it goes into the reduction gear, which then drives the propeller. But then you also have the prop governor, it's actually round and circular to allow that cannon to go through the propeller. So very unique, very innovative design during that time.
Smile
so.
To the camera.
Yeah, you bet. Smiling here.
Okay. And it has the Aero Products prop, which is a little different than the ham standards we have over here.
Right? It is different, and there's some people that question it. I do want to say something about the P-39. Back in the day, you know, being unique like it is, there was questions about that drive shaft coming loose, probably like your 39 Ford. You probably, you know, wondered if it was going to come loose and beat the plane apart. And also, too, there was stories about having the engine behind the pilot, and possibly in an accident, having that engine crush the pilot. That was also another big concern. And then having the nose wheel, you know, instead of having a tail wheel, you guys were training in T-6s and other tail wheel type aircraft, and then here your first fighter has this nose wheel out hanging out in the front. So a lot of things that were different to it, but it also then caused some, I'm going to say, some misconceptions, some concerns. I know Colonel Anderson, you even had a drinking song, I believe, that you guys used to sing about the P-39.
Oh, yeah. Feel free to chime in, bud.
Let me see if I got my
your singing voice in.
Little harmonica. Hoot, hoot. We used to have a song, and I know some of the words, and I'm sure there's some more that are more colorful. it goes like this. Don't give me a P-39 with the engine that's mounted behind. She'll loop, roll, and spin, and soon auger in. Don't give me a P-39.
Hey, if Teresa needs backup singer tomorrow, you're in.
I remember the guys used to think that the airplane would tumble, go ass over tea kettle. And I never tumbled one, but I saw some guys rat race around over the field. And he fell out of that and went through a gyration. I'm pretty sure he thought he had tumbled. And after the war, we asked the Bell test pilots, would the P-39 tumble? They said, we did everything in the world to try to make it tumble and couldn't. Then he put out a caveat. But he said it sure did have some unusual post-stall gyrations.
Whatever that meant. Okay. Jack, Bud, any comments on the P-51s you'd like to share? I think we've covered the P-51s quite often before, so we are running a little long, but anything else you want to tell us about the P-39 or your project?
One of the things I would say, and this is in an interview, I had the privilege of interviewing Colonel Anderson in early March, and when we had a chance to... you were in California. We did a video conference. I was actually in our hangar in San Marcos. We have a beautiful World War II hangar where we keep our Central Texas airplanes. And the conversation we were talking about was about, you mentioned about the training that you got. And you also just mentioned it earlier in the P-39 and how that gunnery school, I believe you went to two or three gunnery schools in a P-39 before you went over to Europe. And how you felt like that was a big training advantage before you got your Mustang.
Yeah.
And then the part also too, as we were talking through it, we had a conversation about what if would you let us have the honor of changing our colors to Old Crow back in the day? And I believe you were pretty excited, and you thought that would be okay.
Yeah, I loved it.
Well, Colonel Anderson, we did it. I know we talked about, too, in the interview. We talked about having all three of your fighters together, all three Old Crow fighters together. And here you go, Colonel Anderson.
You know, I would say World War II pilots would just, if you had one airplane painted like the one you had in World War II, that would be great. But for me, I've had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
You lost count, is what that
means. One in Norway.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Just been so lucky, and I'm so proud of these guys that would do this kind of a thing.
And Colonel Anderson, this is exactly the mission of the Commemorative Air Force: to educate, to inspire, and to honor. And this mission did exactly that. And so we're real. What a privilege it to be to have your P-39 back with you and reunite you to your original old crow.
Thank you.
And thank you guys for doing this. It's a beautiful airplane.
When are we going to see these pictures?
The pictures from this morning, I don't know. The production crew, Scott Guyatt and the sleeping dogs, are really, really good. So I'll see how quickly they can put them up. Maybe they can run a reel of the pictures later on on the Jumbotron. I think that'd be great because there are some great pictures, just what I have seen. We can open it up to a couple of questions here. We are running really long, and Colonel Anderson will be over in the Warbird merchandise building here to. His books are already autographed. If you have not read To Fly and Fight, you really need to do that. It is my opinion. I am biased, obviously, but it's the best World War II book out there. Colonel Anderson will go from here over there, but if we have a couple of questions, I think we'll just run long and take them if you've got a question to anyone here on the panel.